And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
And welcome, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. Yes, we are on the air, and you have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, where we learn how to explain, defend the faith with clarity and charity. It's great to be with you today. And, a very interesting topic today as well. You know, Catholic education is woefully inadequate, in my humble opinion. Many schools, you know, their textbooks aren't that good. Their children are lucky if they learn church history, but also I don't think we educate ourselves and our children about Catholic history in America. You know, this whole legacy of anti-Catholicism that's been with us since the beginning of the country. So, you know, kids don't realize that the Spanish were here way before the Pilgrims, and also in the colonies that we were kind of a persecuted minority, and that remained through much of early American history. It really wasn't until the 1960s, when John F. Kennedy, the first Catholic president, was elected, that Catholics kind of felt like they've left the ghetto. You know, that persecution is behind them. And we've forgotten our past. And quite frankly, you can't forget the past, because, you know, that was heady years of the early 1960s didn't last long. Now we're right back to where we were before. And to make matters even worse, we have forgotten our historic past. And that's not good, because the past helps us understand what's going in the present. I know many Catholics are scandalized by fellow Catholics who are pro-abortion and on the wrong side of a lot of issues that you would think even a marginally educated Catholic would know, you know, not to be part of, to fight against, in fact. But they do nevertheless. And, you know, what's interesting is that is not new. And it's not new with Catholicism in America, that our past here has always been a mixed bag of Catholics faithful to the church, Catholics that aren't faithful to the church, that buy into political acceptance or social acceptance, and we've forgotten that. So to help us remember, we're going to have Father Charles Connor on the show. Many of you may be familiar with some of his work on EWTN. He wrote a very fascinating book that I think this would be a great intro for people into our past, and also for those who love the Civil War as a topic. This would be a great way to integrate your Catholic education with Civil War knowledge. The book is called Faith and Fury. Let's see if it makes sure I have it without glare. The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War. And it's a fascinating work. And he does cover, you know, a lot of, you know, the complex situation Catholics had been in this country before, during, and even after the Civil War. So he's going to come on the other side of the break. So that's going to be fascinating. We're also going to do our Finding the Fallacy, our critical thinking skills. And as always, we tackle one of these informal fallacies. Today's fallacy, I don't think really has much of an apologetic application, but nevertheless, we should be aware of it. It is the gambler's fallacy. And we also meet an early church father. And the early church father today is a little known father who actually, you know, we only have fragments of what he wrote, but it is Cassius, the presbyter of Rome. Cassius, the presbyter of Rome. And so lots of great stuff in store for the program. If you have a question for Father Connor, give us a call, 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. And as always, you can send us your emails at questions@handsonapologetics.com. And that comes straight to the dojo mailbox. And I do answer all your emails. And also, I need to give my shout out to those watching on social media, live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Turn my head over here to the social media section of the dojo. And great to see familiar names there. Welcome aboard. And also, I want to welcome all of you listening on radio and also listening to the program via podcast at virginmostpowerfulradio.org. All right. So why don't we jump to the finding the fallacy, which is the gambler's fallacy. Gambler's fallacy, by the way, is also known as the Monte Carlo fallacy or the fallacy of the maturity of chances. And it basically is the mistaken belief that something happens more frequently than normal during a given period. It will happen less frequently in the future, or vice versa. In other words, that if something happens infrequently during a given period, that it'll be more frequent after that period. And so, you know, you can probably figure out how that applies that in gambling. You know, this idea that something is due to win. It's going to pay off. It's just a matter of time. And then there's going to be this maturity of chances where, you know, the big payoff is just around the corner. And the gambler's fallacy works, is true, is truly a fallacy in some circumstances, is not in another. For example, you can make predictions if you're dealing with a fixed group that doesn't change. For example, if you have a deck of cards and the face cards start showing themselves early in a card game, and you know, if cards aren't added to the deck or it isn't reshuffled, you can pretty much bet that face cards would be pretty rare. You know, if they show up early, they won't be showing up later in the game. And that's pretty true. That's pretty much true. But in regards to other phenomenon, it's not always true. For example, if you roll a dice, a six-sided dice, you will have a 1 in 6 chance of hitting any given number, 1 through 6. But no matter how many times you roll the dice, the odds never change. There's never like, well, I haven't rolled 1 in 20 rolls, so eventually, you know, it's going to be due. It's going to be rolling once. Well, that's not true, because every time you roll the dice, it's still only a 1 in 6 chance that you'll roll a 1. So that is the gambler's fallacy. Like I said, I don't think it really has much application in the field of apologetics. At least I can't think of an application, but you never know. So, you know, if anybody can think of a situation where the gambler's fallacy actually fits within discussions about the faith, send me an email. I'd actually like to hear it at questions@handsonapologetics.com, because, quite frankly, I can't think of a situation where I've ever encountered it. All right, so without further ado, why don't we talk about the Meet the Early Church Father for today? And, you know, many of these early church fathers are very familiar, like Augustine, Jerome, Gregory the Great. A lot of them you probably never heard of, but nevertheless, we should know about them because they are part of our past, and they also supply important apologetic information. And it is Cassius, the Presbyter of Rome, who flourished sometime around AD 198 or 217, somewhere in that area. Nothing is known about Cassius. In fact, sometimes he's also known as Gaius, G-A-I-U-S, or Gaius, the Presbyter of the Roman Church. Beyond that, nothing. We only have little fragments that were preserved in Eusebius' church history. He lived during the pontificate of Pope Zephyrinus, who reigned between 198 and 217, hence the dates for his work. And we only have one written work from him. It's a disputation with Proclus, who was a Montanist. And a Montanist, by the way, was a strange sect that came out of Phrygia, who basically believed that public revelation didn't cease with the last apostle, but it continued. So the Montanists had prophets that could give public revelation. They had priestesses, and they were just a very weird sect that actually Tertullian, another church father, joined near the end of his life. Like I said, we only have a couple of fragments from them that were preserved by Eusebius from this disputation. And it actually gives us a very important chunk of information in regards to the seat of the papacy in regards to Peter dying in Rome. So here's what it says. This is from Eusebius, that fragment. Caius says, quote, "It is recorded that Paul was beheaded in Rome itself, and Peter likewise was crucified during the reign of Nero. The account is confirmed by the names of Peter and Paul over the cemeteries there, which remain to the present time. And it's confirmed also that the stalwart man of the church, Gaius, by the name, who lived at the time of Zephyrinus, bishop of Rome, this Gaius had written a dispute with Proclus, the leader of a sect of the Montanist, and says that of that place, in which remains of aforementioned apostles were deposited," he says, quote, okay, so here's the line from our early church father for today. "I can point out the trophies of the apostles, for if you're willing to go to the Vatican or to the Ostian Way, you will find the trophies of those who founded this church." So, you know, again, a tiny little fragment from our early church father, Caius, or Gaius, I guess you would say. And it's important data, too, because that is one of those three things that apologists need to establish the foundation of the papacy. That, number one, that Peter was given a headship or a primacy over the 12 by Jesus. Number two, that there's apostolic succession, so that the apostles and Peter occupy an office that when they die, others will take the office. And then that third part, which this plays into, that Peter dies in Rome. So that's our Meet the Early Church Father for today. Coming up on the other side of the break, Father Charles Connor, and we're going to talk about the Faith and Fury, the rise of Catholicism during the Civil War. Stay tuned, everybody. More to come.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ from my best-selling book, The Devil in the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered, it's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, West Covina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
Jesus said in Luke 17, "When you have done all that you were ordered to do, say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have only done our duty.'" According to St. John of the Cross, God is pleased with the little deeds we do in secret. He takes more pleasure in these than in a multitude of grand works that we may do out of the desire to be seen by others. May God help us to do the things that please Him, and not just to appear great in the eyes of others.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And, you know, while we're getting their guest on the phone, you know, I mentioned before we went to our critical thinking skills, how important it is to be educated in the faith. because, quite frankly, the religious education for middle school, high school, even college level Catholics, in Catholic schools, by the way, is woefully inadequate. And as a result, we're woefully inadequate to defend the faith. And also, it's difficult for us to understand the world that we live in today. You know, if we don't understand the past, we can't really understand the present. So while we're getting our guest on, I thought maybe it'd be great to go and give you some book recommends as far as if you want to learn more about the Catholic faith, you know, what to pick up, what's a good book to grab. So let me give you my first book recommend. And this is a book called The Real History, The Real Story of Catholic History. I wish I had the book here. I could show you the title. It's by our good friend Steve Weidenkopf, who is a historian. And this is an amazing book because what he does is he goes through anti-Catholic history and slices and dices through each and every objection you could possibly think of in just super short sections and gives the mythological position that you'll hear normally in secular history or on TV or even radio, and he'll show you what actually happened, you know, why this is not true. Maybe there's half-truths. He will show you those. And it's a thick book, but it's a quick read because all of these sections are very short. So he will go through myths like going back to the New Testament, that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, or Christianity is just an amalgamation of pagan religion. And he'll go to some very good modern historical sources, many of whom are not Catholic sources, and debunk them. So he'll go through that. He'll tackle all the myths about the Crusades, all the myths about the Inquisition, all the myths about the war between the church and science. He goes all the way through that. And he also covers some myths that have been forgotten. It was kind of fun reading his book because some of the historical things that he uncovers are things that I read about, you know, early on in my career and never saw again. Like, for example, Maria Antoinette's Let Them Eat Cake, the castrados, you know, all sorts of weird things in this thing that we call no popery history, or what Herbert Butterfield called Whig history. You know, these myths that everybody seems to know as true, when in fact they're completely vacuous or they're twisted half-truths. So again, you know, that book recommend is A Real Story of Catholic History. It's by Steve Weidenkopf. And it's available through Catholic Answers Press. So that's one really good book recommend. So if you want to fill out your knowledge in history, that's good. He's also written lots of great books on the Crusades, if that's interest to you, and even touches a little bit, I believe, on the Inquisition. Good stuff from him. Another thing, too, let's see. Another thing you might want to pick up, and this is more early church history, not so much modern church history, is the 3-volume set that we use for our Meet the Church Fathers every segment of the show. And that is Jurgen's Faith of the Early Fathers. It was put out by Liturgical Press. I'm not sure if it still is. But if you Google it, it's Faith of the Early Fathers by Jurgen's. Highly recommend that, just as a really good tool for defending the faith. What Jurgen's does, it's a 3-volume set, so you know it's kind of hefty, but considering that the early church fathers is probably like 30 volumes, you know, it's a lot better to have a 3-volume set than like 30 plus volumes of early church fathers writings. And this is what he does. He goes through the early church fathers and he looks at them in terms of doctrine. And so he goes chronologically. He begins at the very beginning. I think he starts with the Didache or First Clement. And he will just give little quotations, like a paragraph, of where that writing touches on a particular teaching of the church, whether for or against it. And then it's all basically categorized by numbers. And then the gold part of the book, this is what's really great about Faith and Early Fathers. If you flip to the back, the indices has a doctrinal indice or index that goes through particular doctrines, and it'll list all the paragraph numbers of all the church fathers who commented on that particular doctrine. So let's say somebody comes to you and they deny the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary, and you want to be able to show them, no, the early church fathers had this idea. All you have to do is pick up Jurgens, go to the back, the index, look up the Immaculate Conception, and just jot down all those numbers that he gives, and bang, you have all the quotes from, you know, the early church fathers on that particular doctrine. Very, very powerful instrument for apologetics. And also, you know, if you don't have a lot of time, maybe pick it up and then just once a day, just go through, a couple, maybe just one early father in Jurgens. And you can get basically like all the best quotes, so to speak, the ones that you really need to know. And he does a fantastic job with that. And like I said, that is where we get the Meet the Early Church Fathers. We get all the information for our shows from this three-volume set. So that's my other book recommend for those who want to expand their knowledge of the Catholic faith. I should probably number these. I should have went from 10 or 15 to 1. But actually, it'd be tough to rate them because they're all good in their own special way. Another thing, a great book I'd like to recommend, and I recommended this on a previous show. Let's say people are challenging you on your faith. Maybe you turn on the radio, you watch the television program, they made some sort of accusations about church doctrine or teaching or whatever, and you want to start getting into apologetics, but you don't know where to start. Well, the first thing you did is, of course, turn on Hands-On Apologetics on Virgin Most Powerful Radio, right? Okay, and then there you hear the book recommends today, and here's where you go. Okay, the first book I think every Catholic should own and read is Theology for Beginners by Frank Sheed. That's the first book on my list for someone who doesn't know anything about apologetics, but you want to learn more and kind of fill out your knowledge of the faith. That's the place to go. Theology for Beginners, Frank Sheed. And that's available through Servant Publications. I believe it's still in print. And what's the beautiful thing with Frank Sheed is that he was trained in public speaking. He used to go to Hyde Park and basically defend Catholic faith and groups of people in Hyde Park. He'd get on the proverbial soapbox and people would throw objections out. And he learned how to think on his feet and to present material in a way that engaged the audience. So those are just some books. And, of course, I have to recommend also this book, Faith and Fury, The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War. And it's by Father Charles Connor. And he just so happens to be our guest today. Father Charles Connor is a faculty member of Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and is expert on church history. And you probably know him best as a host of several television series on EWTN, including Historic Catholic Converts. And Father Connor, welcome to Hands-On Apologetics.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very delighted and honored to be with you today.
Well, it's the honor is all mine, because this is a fascinating book. I was just telling the audience that, in my humble opinion, Catholic education has woefully educated us in the history of our church in America. You know, we might know some things about maybe the early church, but when it comes to like the Know-Nothing Party or, you know, some of these anti-Catholic movements in early Christian history, I think most Catholics are totally oblivious to it.
Absolutely. I very much get that same feeling. And I think that, most of our co-religionists really don't even begin to know the terrible, terrible bigotry. You can take every period of United States history, and there's really not a period to be excluded from the colonial days where you do not find very, very pronounced anti-Catholic bigotry. And it really proves, I think, the truth of a statement It was made by an American historian years ago, Arthur Schlesinger Sr. Schlesinger said, anti-Catholicism is the most deep-seated bias in the American people. And really, I have, to this day, I've not found anything to contradict it. You know, I think he made a very, very interesting and true observation there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it seems as if, you know, after the election of John F. Kennedy, Catholics kind of got this idea that, well, persecution's over, we're one with America, we fit in. And, you know, the honeymoon didn't last very long, and we're kind of back where we were.
Really,
yeah.
From where we are, you know, as a religion, Kennedy tremendously diluted the Catholic relationship to the United States in that sermon, that talk he gave to the Houston ministers. And some years ago, Archbishop Chaput in Philadelphia gave a magnificent response, you know, talking about the incorrectness of what Kennedy said that day. So our amalgamation into American society has really, in many, many ways, watered down who we are and what we are about in America.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I'm so pleased with your book. I really enjoyed reading it because, you know, it does kind of refresh our memory about where we came from, and it helps helps us understand all the confusion that we're in right now.
Oh, I think that's very true. I think especially when you study United States Catholic history, it proves that a truth that now St. John Henry Newman made. He was talking about the study of history, church history in general, and he said that no sooner have we stopped singing our Alleluias than we're chanting our Misereres. And of course, what he meant by that, you know, was that it's the ebb and flow of the story of United States Catholic history. And while we've had many opportunities, of course, to display our patriotism, and while we have presented many, many people who have strongly maintained their Catholicity while becoming prominent on the national scene and all the rest, nonetheless, we have experienced an awful lot of negatives in our history in this country as well. You know, we were the foreigners, we were the invaders, so to speak, and we represented a very strange kind of religion that the basic Anglo-American just simply could not comprehend at all. And this was at the very basis of the objection all the way back in colonial days.
I hear the music coming up, Father. We'll continue this on the other side of the break. I'm chatting with Father Charles Connor on his book, Faith and Fury, The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War.
Welcome, Daniel. You're on the line. What's on your mind, brother?
Hi, I just wanted to share a testimony about Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I had a buddy at work who, you know, he's a lukewarm Catholic guy, and I wanted him to start listening to the Terry and Jesse show, so I kept telling him to download the app, and he kept putting me off. So one day, I grabbed his phone, and I downloaded the app for him. I went on vacation, and you know, I kept telling him to listen to it. He was kind of putting me off. I came back from vacation. He comes to my cubicle, and he says to me, "Hey, man, I've been listening to the Terry and Jesse show, and it's great." And it's made a big impact in his life. The guy, he's going to weekly adoration a couple times a week. He goes to the Mass in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's an on-fire Catholic, and he promotes the Terry and Jesse show and the Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Wow. Daniel, what a testimony. And I want to encourage our listeners to get those cards by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and do what Daniel's doing. Go out and spread the faith by inviting people to listen to Virgin Most Powerful. Daniel, thanks for your testimony, brother. God love you.
You're welcome.
This is Terry Barber. I want to invite you to take advantage of having your funeral or your loved one's funeral at the Sacred Heart Chapel in downtown Covina. It's a 115-year-old church, beautiful chapel. And all you got to do is call me at 661-972-7872, and I'll personally make the arrangements with your mortuary to have your funeral or your loved one's funeral here at Sacred Heart Chapel. You won't regret it. 661-972-7872. God love you.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Father Charles Conner on his book, Faith and Fury, The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War. And sorry, Father, right before the break, you were talking about how Catholics were seen as these foreigners, even invaders. And, within that midst, you would hope that Catholics would stand true to the faith and stand up publicly, but a lot of Catholics tried to just go with the flow and fit in, didn't they?
Yes, that's kind of a sad chapter in the story itself, and yet you look at such episodes that were directed against us. For example, the burning of the Ursuline Convent in Charlestown, Massachusetts, or the Kensington riots in Philadelphia, or the proposed riots in New York City in the 1840s. And in some way, in those days, you could argue that it made the faith stronger. It certainly made Catholics more militant because they were fighting for what they believed in. That was true in the 1840s with the Native Americans. It was true in the 1850s with the Know-Nothing Party. And certainly during the war years themselves, 1861 to 65, you have a magnificent opportunity on the part of Catholics, both North and South, whatever part of the country they found themselves living in, to strongly display their patriotism for either the Confederacy or the Union by fighting in those respective armies. And then, of course, after the war was over, you have the same scenario raising its head again, because there were many in the American press who said that absolutely there was a Catholic plot to kill Lincoln. And the reason they came up with that, of course, was because of Mary Surratt, who was the owner of the boarding house in Washington on 8th Street, where John Wilkes Booth and the conspirators met to plan their abduction and their murder of the president and other members of the cabinet. And the fact that after John Wilkes Booth escaped Ford's Theater that evening, after he had shot the president, the famous story of him falling out of the booth, and breaking his leg and so forth, and he got out and got himself to a horse and rode all the way to Southern Maryland. And in Southern Maryland, of course, his wounds were tended to by Dr. Samuel Mudd, who was a very, very staunch Catholic in Bryantown. These events, of course, obviously did not make the church look good at all. But nonetheless, we continued, and through Reconstruction, you have the rebuilding of the country after the Civil War. But you also, synonymous with that, you have the struggle over the reading of Bible reading in the public schools. And of course, many of the Catholic bishops and Catholic people were protesting the fact that their children, Catholic children, had to read the King James Version. And you had, as a result of this, Ulysses S. Grant, the famous Union general who was now president of the United States, talking about how divisive Catholic schools were and how Catholic schools should not get 1 cent of federal money and so on and so forth. And he, in many of his public addresses, he displayed strong anti-Catholicism. So again, as I say, it's this ongoing story growth on the one hand, certainly a very, very impressive growth in the physical plan of the church in the United States, but nonetheless we were still we never ceased to fight an uphill battle, if you were. It's just that the events varied from time to time in our history. But nonetheless, it's we've been fighting almost since the day we got here in colonial days. And as you said there, Jerry, right at the beginning there, most of our Catholic people, I am sure, don't know the terrible difficulties we've had in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the issue of slavery. This is something I think many Catholics would be surprised First, what was the Catholic Church's position on non-just title slavery? And how was the response of Catholics in America to the Church's position on slavery?
Well, to begin with, I think it's good to have a little bit of background here. And the background could take us several centuries back.
Right.
Because the issue of slavery had been raised by any number of popes over the years. And it was, in response to the institution as it existed in various parts of the world at various periods of time. There was a uniform condemnation of slavery on the part of any number of popes. Father Joel Panzer has done a very, very careful, a very fine study of this, in fact. And by the time it gets down to us, of course, in the 1860s or even earlier, in the mid-19th century or so, we were the last vestige holding on to slavery in the civilized world. I mean, England, for example, had repealed slavery back in the 1830s. So we were the only ones. Now, slavery had been brought over here in the earliest colonial times. And by the time you got to the mid-19th century, it was very, very much an accepted social institution in the United States, and it was an institution which conservative people in general were very, very slow to try to overturn, because people, oftentimes being conservative by nature, do not run away from social upheaval, and they saw the overthrow of slavery as little short of a social upheaval in the fabric of American society. And the only people who began, or the, I should say the earliest people who began a strong moral indignation toward the institution of slavery, pointing out very, very correctly that it was an institution that held people in bondage, and they, of course, were the abolitionists. And they began early, about 1830, I guess, with William Lloyd Garrison and his famous newspaper, The Liberator. And they grew in strength and they grew in numbers. Their early years, they were looked upon very, very much as fanatics, particularly by white Southern slaveholding people. But the other interesting point, as far as the Catholic Church is concerned, is this. While these abolitionists held very clearly and very correctly, as I say, the fact that slavery was an immoral institution because of the human bondage that was involved here, nonetheless, the abolitionists would say that the Catholic Church was an equally immoral institution, because the Catholic Church, in other words, if slavery held people in social and political bondage, the Catholic Church held people in spiritual bondage. Mm. People were told what to believe. People were dictated to by the Pope. People had a very, very strange set of individual beliefs. It was a strange way to interpret Christianity. Give them enough leeway, and the Pope will, of course, try to run the United States, and the whole system of Catholicism was strongly inimical to American rights and liberties, and on and on and on. So, I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to find organized groups who were any more anti-Catholic than the abolitionists. Huh. So, of course, the Catholic bishops get a bum rap, naturally, for not being stronger in their advocacy against slavery. At the same time, it has to be remembered, I think, that Catholic bishops in no way, shape, or form were going to join forces with abolitionism that was so opposed to the Catholic Church. I mean, that would be unheard of, and it would be unthought of, and so on and so forth. So what the Catholic bishops did, and some of them were very clear spokesmen, even going back to the 1820s, you had Bishop John England in Charleston. In the 1840s and 50s, you had John Hughes, the very, very powerful Archbishop of New York, who wrote extensively on the question of slavery. You had Francis Patrick Kenrick, who was the Archbishop of Baltimore, who was probably the finest moral theologian in the American hierarchy in this time. Well, in any event, all of these men accepted the premise of the social acceptability of slavery, because it had been developed here for so long, but at the same time, they morally condemned the slave trade. And by the slave trade, we mean simply the buying and selling of human beings, the breaking up of families and all this kind of thing, which went on very randomly, but also, you know, it was a very, very common thing is what I'm trying to say. So they distinguished between the two, and they also were at great pains to issue pastoral letters, for example, directed to Catholic slave owners. And they were very clear on the strong moral obligation that every slave owner had in the United States to make certain that all the slaves living on his plantation would have been baptized, would have received the sacraments of the church, and would have been taught all the tenets of the Catholic faith. And in particular, that these people, that these slaves, were taught a moral way of life, because you know that they had had no exposure, if you will, to organized morality as such. And on many of the plantations that were not Catholic, of course, the slaves lived any darn way they wanted to morally, but then, of course, the slave owners lived any darn way they wanted to morally either. And there was, slave owners, for example, who would take the young black slave girls as their mistresses, and children would be born of these unions, and on and on and on. Well, what happened, of course, was that the bishops were very, very concerned with all the moral implications of this, and there are tremendous examples of one that comes to my mind immediately would be an Irish immigrant by the name of his first name was Healy. Patrick, I believe it was, who bought a large plantation in Georgia, and he had several dozen slaves. And, you know, one of the slave girls, he married in the faith, and she became the mother of his 10 children. And of the 10 children, 4 of them became priests. And one of them was Bishop James Augustine Healy, who was the Bishop of Portland, Maine. And another brother was a Jesuit who became president of Georgetown College, and so on and so forth. So, you know, there are wonderful, wonderful stories of those who had been raised as slaves, who, of course, turned out to be marvelous Catholics, and who also lived in a way that was in accord always with, you know, with church teaching and all the rest. I think the probably the saddest chapter directly relating to slavery is when we would describe it as the former institution of slavery after Lincoln's proclamation and freeing the slaves and in those parts were in rebellion against the United States, and then the subsequent action, of course, of the Congressional Amendment, which freed them.
Yeah, very good. Well, we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. I hear the music coming up.
Yeah,
we're okay, chatting with fine. Father Charles Connor about his book, Faith and Fury, The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War. Stay tuned, folks. More to come.
This is Jesse Romero.
And I'm Terry Barber.
From the Terry and Jesse Show. And we invite you to listen to the Holy Hour of Power, High Energy Catholic Radio. We're two Catholics with a PhD in common sense. We're on Monday through Friday on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
What we're going to give you is masculine Catholic teachings on the faith. You know, we say we're too inspired to be tired, we're too protected to be dejected, and we're too renewed to be subdued. Why? Because we believe in Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church. And we will take each issue of the day and show you how the Catholic Church has the answer for our culture. What we really do is bring men back into the Catholic Church, which it's about time to do. We want men to be leaders in their Catholic faith so that they can bring their family to heaven.
Our program is not right versus left. It's right versus wrong. And our program is where Catholicism and culture intersect. It's High Energy Catholic Radio.
We're going to inspire you to fall deeper in love with Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church.
The Terry and Jesse Show on the Virgin Most Powerful app.
Jesus said in Matthew 26, "Stay awake and pray that you may not enter into temptation." According to St. Ephrem, Jesus, who feared nothing, experienced fear and asked to be freed from death, although he knew it was impossible. How much more must we persevere in prayer before temptation assails us, so that we may be freed when the test has come? May God grant that we may withstand temptation and carry out His will in all things.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back. And we are chatting with Father Charles Connor about his book, Faith and Fury, The Rise of Catholicism During the Civil War. And Father, boy, what a masterful job recounting all that history. You know, it's fascinating that there were Catholics on both sides of the Civil War, wasn't there?
Jerry, and really, they were as divided on political issues as were any of their fellow Americans. You know, if you were a Catholic in the South, you favored what we would refer to usually as the compact theory of government. If you were a Catholic in the North, you would be an adherent to the organic theory. The organic theory of government simply would say that the delegates came to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, and they created a federal government with expressed, enumerated, delegated, and implied powers. And the residual powers that were left over, if you want to put it that way, were retained by the states. And the compact theory of government, of course, would be quite the opposite, and it would say that, you know, these individual states were 13 individual sovereignties who came together, who created a government, but who retained the right, because of the inherent sovereign nature of the state itself, they retained the right to withdraw from that union if indeed something was, that the government which they had created was opposed to the very tenets and principles upon which they stood as a state government. And of course, they were the two theories of government that were strongly, strongly fought over during this whole mid-19th century period. And many people would, I suppose, rather simplistically say that the Civil War was fought over the issue of slavery. No, the Civil War was not fought over slavery at all. The Civil War was fought over one theory of government versus another, and slavery happened to be the practical manifestation of those two theories of government, one side being opposed, the other side being very, very much in favor of it, particularly because it was such a strong economic staple. But if you would ever want to see or to experience the differences in Catholics North versus South, you would want to read the correspondence that took place in a number of American newspapers between Archbishop John Hughes of New York and Bishop Patrick Lynch of Charleston, South Carolina. And there you will find expressed very, very clearly these two theories of government that we try to outline. Both of these men were natives of Ireland. Both came over here, and Lynch, as I say, became the Bishop of Charleston, and John Hughes, who was one of our graduates from Mount St. Mary's here in Emmitsburg, ultimately became the Archbishop of New York. He succeeded John Dubois in New York, and of course it was Dubois, who also was one of our founders here, who had accepted Hughes as a student here at the Mount back early in the 19th century. Well, anyway, that Hughes-Lynch correspondence clearly underscores these differences. And what is even more to the point here is that both of these men, Hughes and Lynch, undertook diplomatic missions for their respective parts of the country. Archbishop Hughes went to France at the request of the Lincoln administration to try to maintain French neutrality. They were scared, obviously, of France's recognition of the Confederacy or military help or manpower help or the like. And to that extent, you would have to say, I think, that Hughes was very, very successful. Bishop Lynch, on the other hand, from Charleston, undertook a mission for Jefferson Davis and his cabinet to try to secure official Vatican recognition for the Confederate States, and in that the bishop was not successful. Pius IX was known to personally personally favor the side of the Confederacy for a number of reasons, but he would not make any kind of a public stand to that effect. But in any event, as I say, there are some practical examples I think we can bring up immediately for the differences North versus South. And then, of course, you have significant differences in the Catholic press, North versus South, and they will speak to all the political issues of the day, as well as the institution of slavery and so on and so forth. And even within that context, you had, in a special way, you had Northern Catholic editors of newspapers who would take a Southern position, which was a curious kind of a thing. You had James Alphonsus McMaster, who's the editor of the New York Freedmen's Journal, strong on Catholic paper in New York, who would have been very, very pro-South in his thinking and extraordinarily anti-Lincoln. You had an editor like Courtney Jenkins in Baltimore, who was an avowed promoter of the Confederate cause. And although Maryland remained loyal to the Union, of course, there was very, very divided allegiances here in Maryland because, you know, we are a border state here. So in any event, yes, to answer your question, that was a long answer, but to answer your question, yes, indeed, there were all kinds of divisions between and among Catholics. The very interesting point, though, that we have to make here as well as this. You had, within particularly Protestant denominations in America, you had the official splitting of these churches. For example, where does the concept of a Southern Baptist come from? It comes from this period of time. The Baptist Church split. The Southern Baptists, of course, very strong proponents of slavery. The Northern Baptists, very much opposed to it. But the church as an organization split, as did other Christian denominations. Under no circumstance at any time was there the remotest idea of any kind of a break in the unity of Catholic faith, in the unity of Catholic doctrine. That would have been positively unheard of. If you were a Catholic, you were a Catholic. And unfortunately, we can't say that today, but I wish we could. But in those days, we certainly could say it. And none of that was even remotely thought to be broken during these years when there was such political and social division in the country, which is a magnificent tribute to the fullness of faith we have in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that actually caused schism within certain Protestant denominations, but the Catholics, you know, held to unity, although they had very divergent opinions. Mm-hmm. So in matters of government, I think Catholics have latitude as to disagree on what is the best form of government.
Oh, sure. So certainly, sure. No question of that.
Yeah, so what were what's the aftermath of the Civil War? How did it change Catholicism in America?
Well, of course, it changed it, I suppose, in the sense that you clearly saw emerged after the Civil War the very, very urban character of Catholicism. Catholicism was the religion of the city dweller, whether you found it in the North or in the South, and to a much lesser extent, the religion of the rural dweller. Therefore, it was a religion that was going to, because it was so much associated with the cities, it was a religion that was going to become very, very associated with, for example, laboring men in the late 19th century and into the 20th century. And that was going to, of course, provoke a lot of problems itself for the church in the late 19th century. In fact, as we talk, I've already begun a book on that subject, which, please God, I'll have done about a year from now or so. But you can have me out again, Jerry. I'll tell you all about that story.
Absolutely.
But in any event, it changed Catholicism in the sense that there was a mold that had been created to a certain degree in the mid-19th century, but it really came into fruition after the Civil War veterans went home. They, in most instances, joined the American labor force, naturally. And this is what really accounted for the composition of Catholicism as it went into the 20th century. And for many decades of the 20th century, and that basic composition really did not begin to change in Catholicism, I don't think, until after the Second World War, when you had the tremendous move to the suburbs of the United States and, the birth of the the baby boom generation, the children born of World War II veterans and all that, who have not necessarily done the best job possible, I don't think, carrying out the strength of faith. But with the move to the suburbs, you really and truly begin to experience the dilution of Catholicism in many ways, which is a totally different story, of course. But to answer your question, how the war changed Catholicism, I think it changed in the new configuration that Catholicism began to assume almost immediately after the war's conclusion.
Hmm. Yeah. Did the church help with Reconstruction, the healing the nation after the war?
No, not a great deal, I wouldn't say. It was a sad chapter, and I say that because of the war was only ended 1 year when we had the Second Plenary Council of Baltimore, and one of the points that was discussed by the Council Fathers in Baltimore, well, in fact, to show you how much we had grown as a church, Andrew Johnson, who was Lincoln's successor in the presidency, attended the closing session of the Second Plenary Council. It was quite a scene to behold, we're told, on Mulberry Street there in Baltimore, where the great basilica still stands, the Assumption of Our Lady. In any event, one of the questions brought up at the Second Plenary Council, because now we were in Reconstruction, was the entire question of black evangelization. You have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of freed slaves. What are we going to do? Are we going to reach out to them as a church and try to bring them in? There was a famous letter that was exchanged between Bishop Spaulding, I believe, Martin J. Spaulding of Baltimore, and he was writing to Cardinal McCluskey in New York, and he said, this is a tremendous opportunity that we now have, and if it is lost, it may never come back again. Well, in point of fact, it was lost, and the opportunity never did come back again. And the overwhelming percentage of African Americans in the United States, quite obviously today, are not Catholic. One of the reasons why they're not Catholic is nothing was done about it after the Civil War. Why was nothing done about it? Primarily racial reasons. Who wants to be bothered with the free blacks and so on and so on and so on? Some people have argued, some historians have argued, other motives. Black tribal practices would not correspond to the Catholic solemnity of the Catholic liturgy, and these people would not feel at home and all this business. And there may be some truth to some of this reasoning, but I mean, I'd say it was primarily a racial reason why nothing was ever done. And yet, imagine if we could say today that 95% or 90% or something of the African American population in America were staunch Roman Catholics, what they would have brought to Catholicism would be positively phenomenal because of their fervor, because of their devotion, and so on and so forth. But that did not happen. And it did not happen for racial reasons, and therefore, as I say, it's a very, very sad chapter, I would say, in church history in this country.
Right. Well, Father, thank you so much for coming on the program. Where can people go to get your book?
Oh, my honor, Gary, to be with you.
Where can they get your book?
Oh, certainly through Amazon, but also through Sophia Institute Press up in Nashua, New Hampshire, or they may call EWTN directly, the Catholic Television Network, the customer service, EWTN in Birmingham. You can order directly from the network. You can order directly from Sophia Institute Press. You can find it in most Catholic bookstores, and you can find it on Amazon.
Very good. Well, thank you, Father. And that concludes our program. Coming up next, the Terry and Jesse Show. Stay tuned, folks.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church, So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.